to another edition of the Media Twits. I'm Mark Glazer, executive editor of PBS Media Shift. Rafat Ali is away this week, but joining us is Dorian Benkoil of Teaming Media and Media Shift. Thanks for coming on, Dorian.
You're welcome, Mark. Hi.
Hey. So I guess the first big news that is kind of swallowing all the other news is the affairs of the U.S. generals, Petraeus in general from the CIA, and this whole thing of kind of a affair scandal that came through email, generally, that I guess these generals felt like they could say anything over email and not have it read.
I know, it's surprising. It's surprising to think that you know, certainly the most famous military person in the most powerful military in the world would be so naive as to think Gmail was anything close to secure.
Yeah, especially, you know, you're the head of the CIA. I guess you assume, well, no one's going to read, you know, you're the one who should be able to read everyone else's email, and no one should read your email.
There were all kinds of people wondering what the heck was going on a number of levels yesterday. You know, the incredible amount of hubris, the incredible lack of caution. It's kind of mystifying. But you know, I guess as a both issue of moral standing and also a media strategy, the fact that he resigned so quickly was probably a way to handle it. I suppose he was hoping that would keep the media fury down a little bit, but of course it hasn't.
No, and I think just for everyone out there who has to, you know, I think it's just something that bears repeating so many times that, you know, when you text someone or when you email someone, if you're doing something electronically, there's almost always a trail and a tracking, and that data seems to live forever.
I heard an analyst on a national public radio or public radio show yesterday while I was driving, talking about, I was in Los Angeles driving yesterday, and I heard an analyst talking about saying, I never send an email until I've read it to make sure. I would not be embarrassed if it appeared on the front page of the New York Times. So that's a pretty high standard that this person who's an analyst and a book author holds himself to, and I guess he was implying that Petraeus should have held himself to the same standard.
Yeah. So, Dorian, you're attending the Digital Hollywood New York show right now. How has that been so far?
What I see is a trend that's reinforced that I've been seeing at a bunch of different conferences. I go to, you know, media business conferences a lot, and I increasingly see brands, you know, just things like consumer products and retail companies presenting on panels at these conferences in the guise of media companies. And I think more and more we're getting to a world where the retailers and the people who make and sell products are themselves seeing themselves as media companies rather than having to go through quote-unquote media companies to deliver their messages to people.
And is that driven a lot by social media, that they have their own social presence and that they can kind of publish their own thoughts in those places?
Yeah, it's driven by, you know, Facebook pages and Twitter feeds and Pinterest, and then, you know, back to their websites, the YouTube channels, videos. I mean, it really runs the gamut. I think social has amped it up and increased the velocity, but I really think it's a whole ecosystem that's developed where, you know, some of it's long form, some of it's short form, but the amount of self-produced stuff is just increasing by quite a lot.
Yeah, definitely. Well, we'll be talking about that a little bit more with Josh Stearns. The first segment will be about kind of digital literacy and the online tracking that goes on. Josh wrote a recent article about saying that we really need a lot more literacy, a lot more knowledge about the tracking that happens online. And then we'll talk about the Ford Foundation giving grants to the Los Angeles Times and Washington Post to help them hire reporters. And we'll have Jonathan Barzilay from the Ford Foundation, as well as NYU's Jay Rosen, to talk about those grants. So first, let's talk about digital literacy and online tracking. Josh Stearns of Free Press argues that we need a truth campaign for data tracking, similar to what tobacco companies funded to spread awareness about the dangers of smoking. Stearns writes in MediaShift that online companies who make money off of our data should fund a campaign to educate people about their data. Would that idea fly? Joining us is Josh Stearns, who's journalism and public media campaign director for Free Press, a national nonpartisan nonprofit organization working to reform the media through education, organizing, and advocacy. Welcome to the Media Schwitz, Josh.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
So we both, we asked people from Google and Facebook, an interactive advertising bureau, to join us to give their side, and they declined to participate. But tell us about the concept that you brought up in this MediaShift article, and is it something you've been thinking about for a while?
I have been. I think over the past few months, there have been a number of articles about very different ways that organizations and companies are collecting and using our data. And as I heard about one story after another, whether it be Target analyzing your credit card purchases and knowing whether you were pregnant even before the rest of your family did, or whether it was the way the political campaigns used deeply, deeply targeted data to craft their messages to reach individual voters, I was just hearing these stories and realizing that for the most part, these things sound on the surface mundane. Some would even argue it's helping you. You're getting more targeted information so that you don't have to wade through the mass that's out there. But under that, I felt like there was a real current of troubling possibilities of what this data could be used for and how this targeting could actually turn into discrimination. But at its most basic, the problem was that we don't control how that data is being collected from us and how it can be used. And so I wanted to think about what kind of campaign could help people better control their data. And before they could control their data, they have to understand how that data is being used. And that's where I came around to this idea of data or digital literacy.
Yeah, and what is the state of education around this? Because it seems like people don't really have a good grasp about, their trails online, who's tracking them, what exactly they're tracking. Is it, there's always talk about this tracking not being personally identified information, that it's not specifically about you. It might just be that you're a male, or you're this age, or this is where you live. What is it that people, do you feel like people are starting to understand more about it, or do you think they're still largely in the dark?
I think people are hearing a lot more about it, but I don't think that means that people are understanding it. And there's two reasons for that, really. I think one, there's a lot of great groups that are working on these issues and thinking about these issues, but they haven't really kind of come together in sort of a unified platform and really designed something that reaches out to the public. And there's been good journalism on this as well, but again, that's not being seen by everybody. It relies on people finding it. And so I think that we need to think about a campaign that actually goes out and meets people where they are and actually brings some of these facts to them. And I also think, this is an incredibly complicated, technical, and wonky issue that is not very transparent from the companies that are using our data or collecting it, how it works, how it functions, what they're actually using, collecting, and how that's able to identify us. So I think there's two questions there. One is, how can we get more transparency about this information, and then how can we educate people about it?
Hi, this is Dorian. I obviously read your column on MediaShift and thought it was well argued and well crafted, but there was one thing that gave me pause. When you made an analogy to the tobacco industry, you said the tobacco industry was required to, as part of their make good on having covered up information about cancer for all those years, they had to fund the campaign that revealed so much information about the dangers of tobacco. And then you said, the people who do data should have to do something similar. Data for marketing and advertising should have to do the same thing. But the thing that gave me pause is, this use of data can be creepy, even invasive, inappropriate. But it doesn't kill you, and it's not like, the advertising industry has been for decades covering up studies that showed that what they're doing, you know, caused disease and death. So I'm a little, you know, to me it seems a bit, what you were calling for, if maybe I'm mischaracterizing it, but you know, it did seem a bit draconian to draw that kind of parallel.
Well, I mean, let's look at the Truth Campaign for a second. The way that that was funded was not that the tobacco companies were forced to fund an education campaign that inherently works against them. It was that a number of states, over 40 states, sued the tobacco industry, won that lawsuit, and the states together decided that they would use a portion of that money to fund this educational effort. And so what I'm arguing in my piece is that before we get to that point where we have attorney generals around the U.S. starting to sue these marketing companies or social networking companies or credit card companies or other companies, there's a huge array of companies in the mix here. Before we get to that point, why not ask these marketing companies and others to come to the table and talk about how a digital literacy campaign that they could help contribute to could actually not only help educate, you know, citizens in digital literacy skills and know-how, but also in many ways I think would be a benefit to them. I think having a more digital literate citizenry could be very beneficial to these networks themselves. It's going to increase broadband adoption, according to the FCC, and I think, you know, it's going to help decrease the spread of misinformation. I don't know how many times I've seen on Facebook, OMG, Facebook's going to sell all of your data to the CIA tomorrow unless you do these five things. These kind of fake chainmail social media things that go around there. So there's a way in which we could construct this as a partnership that I think could be pretty powerful. But I think that that's a big ask. And that's why I wanted to start that conversation this way, not suggesting that this should be something legislated off the bat.
Yeah, it sounds to me like you know, tobacco was just illustrative that you weren't necessarily saying that data kills.
To clarify on that point, I mean, I don't think data kills. In fact, I think that there's a lot of great benefits to big data, and that's another thing that can come out of digital literacy is having more people educated on things like health records and electronic forms and that sort of thing that way, and how big data can actually be really useful and transparency could be really useful. But big data and this kind of data analysis and targeting that had happened does have the potential to be a huge civil rights issue. And there's a great article that I reference in my piece on PBS Media Shift that actually talks about how, you know, the kind of redlining we saw back when in home loans, you know, that had racial discrimination that really led to the Equal Housing Act. That same kind of redlining could happen. We could see digital redlining where, you know, companies that have this data that can assess, oh, this person's a person of color, this person is a single mother, or this or that, or the other thing, could actually start impacting our ability to get jobs, our ability to get loans, and a whole range of other things that are moving online.
Yeah, I actually can see that. I wonder if the education campaign would take care of that. I mean, there was somebody who works at, I've been around people who are in this a lot. My company did a video for the IAB actually covering their they have a campaign where they have a lot of small businesses lobby Congress to try to make sure that when any bills come down they aren't draconian and don't destroy business if they do some controls on data. But I wonder if education would stop some of the more potential nefarious uses, such as the banking use. If a bank, for example, finds out certain information about you online and you call, on one hand, maybe they market certain products to you, which seems pretty mundane. But on the other hand, if you call for a loan and they say, no, we're not going to give it to you, even though you may have qualified based on what you applied, we've been able to track you online and found out things that make us reject you for the loan. I'm not sure if this kind of education program would solve that issue.
Well, for me, it gets back to establishing ability for users to control how their data is being shared, and they can't control that. They can't use browser tools or other privacy settings if they don't first understand what's at stake. So we need the digital literacy so that people can then begin to be more active consumers and be more literate consumers when it comes to how they're letting their data out there. And then that issue of control gets at what the banks can see and can't see.
What about what the state of the do not track is? Because I know the industry has kind of worked with now the browsers have this kind of do not track thing that you can put that you can opt out of tracking. But now, from what some people are saying, that the industry is looking to kind of back out of that where you say do not track, but they really can still track you. And I saw a Consumers Union kind of has a push to have people tell their representatives in Congress to, strengthen that and make sure that do not track actually means do not track.
Right. And do not track is both a technological fix and a policy fix. And right now, the technology is pretty clear and well established, but the policies are all over the board. And I think what we're seeing is that there's, websites that are saying, well, we'll respect part of the do not track, but there's still a couple things we're going to track. Or, I saw at one point in time a website that was, you landed on it, and if you had do not track turned on, it actually said, well, you can't actually use our website. We don't want to bother with you if you're going to have that on your browser. So I think the do not track work is really important, and I really applaud the Consumers Union effort to try to strengthen that. And again, I think that that's a place where, at least initially, the companies and the public interest were able to come together even before it got into policy and law and try to work out a solution. But that solution also only exists online. So that really only matters with where you're going online, which is obviously a huge part of where data is collected. But we also have things about how data is collected through our cell phones, through our credit cards, and other things. And that's why I think the broader literacy and education effort actually allows us to get at the fundamental roots of the problem, and these questions about your data as now this thing that's being marketed, sold, mined, and this Verizon quote that I use in the article about how data is the new oil is something that I think if people understood what the implications of that were, not just online but offline, it would take us a long way towards starting to address that.
Well, thanks a lot, Josh. I really appreciate you joining us. And it's definitely a topic that we're going to return to, again and again. And hopefully we'll get kind of bring in some other voices and hear, what the IAB and some other groups have to say about this.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to having a larger conversation and bringing those groups to the table. I think that if nothing else, we need to just start talking about this in a more open and accessible way.
Okay. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Mark.
So now let's talk about the Ford Foundation and how it's been giving grants lately to newspapers such as the LA Times and Washington Post. This year, the Ford Foundation has given these grants to the newspapers to help them boost reporting and hire editorial people. It's an unusual move for a foundation to fund a for-profit enterprise, but shows just how important public service journalism is for democracy. The grant to the LA Times went to help boost immigration coverage, and the Washington Post grant went to help a deeper look into money and politics. Joining us is Jonathan Barzilay, who's director of the Ford Foundation's Freedom of Expression Unit, managing support for public service journalism, media rights and access, arts and culture, and religion in the public sphere. Previously, he held senior management positions at ABC, CBS, and Qualcomm's Flow TV. Welcome to the show, Jonathan.
Thanks, Mark. Great to be here.
Jay Rosen has been on the faculty at NYU since 1986, and from 1999 to 2005, he served as chair of the department. He's the author of Press Think, a weblog about journalism and its ordeals, which he introduced in September 2003. In June 2005, Press Think won the Reporters Without Borders Freedom Blog Award for outstanding defense of freedom of expression. Welcome to the show, Jay.
Thank you very much.
So, Jonathan, tell us a little bit, give us a little background about these grants. What was the thinking behind them, and why did you guys decide to do them?
The Ford Foundation has a long-standing interest in journalism, and sort of a parallel interest in access to media. They're two sister initiatives that sit side by side here at the foundation. And the lion's share of our work in the journalism space has been around public media. We support NPR and a number of producing entities that contribute to NPR. We support engines of the PBS system. And over time, of course, we've also begun to support new models such as ProPublica or Global Post, hybrid models. And as we looked at the landscape and how much it was evolving, we also realized that there was a place for us to consider supporting serious journalism that was no longer being sustained in some of the traditional newsrooms of the country, even though those were also for-profit models. Our interest is to preserve and advance journalism in the public interest, to ensure that complex social issues receive serious and nuanced coverage. And we had a series of discussions with a number of newsrooms. The LA Times and the Washington Post crafted proposals for us, and this was work that they would not have been able to undertake without foundation support. And we thought that it would make a contribution. So we gave the LA Times a 2-year grant, and for the Washington Post, it's a 1-year grant that's renewable for a second and a third year. So that's basically how it came to pass.
And when you talk about the Washington Post being renewable, will they have to hit certain targets? What kind of goals do you have with this? I mean, outside of, I know that they're going to kind of do more coverage of certain topics. They're hiring some reporters. Is there some way that you'll be measuring kind of the impact of your grants?
Yeah, the answer to that is, yes, we look at both the social impact and the quality of the journalism, and we'll look at that and we'll ask others to take a look at it as well. No grant, whether it's made to a public or a private entity, is automatically renewable in perpetuity, but we go into this, optimistic that we'll find success and open to the notion of renewing it. It was encouraging to us that when the LA Times announced its own grant, even though it's a 2-year grant, that Devon Maharaj, who's the editor of the paper, wrote in his memo to the staff that he anticipated continuing these beats in their 5 reporting slots that we're supporting at the LA Times beyond the expiration of the grant. So, that also suggests that one of the virtues of what we're doing clearly is to sustain this reporting for the duration of the grant. But another benefit of it is that it allows the newspapers to do work that they wouldn't otherwise do, to begin to work that into the fabric of the newsroom, perhaps to seek additional funding, perhaps to take a look at new models themselves, perhaps to use this as a way to approach different partnerships. So we're optimistic that the work will be excellent and that the work will continue beyond the term of the grant.
And Jay, you had some concerns about some of these grants, and I'm guessing some of that was, I guess, the idea of a foundation kind of supporting a, kind of a for-profit enterprise. What were your concerns about it?
Well, I just thought it was kind of odd for a number of reasons, and perhaps there are answers to these things. But one thing is, yes, these are for-profit entities, and when they were making 20% to 30% a year, they weren't putting aside any of that money for the future or for public service expenses like this. I suppose if they return to profitability, they'll be able to return to that behavior. So that's one thing. Another thing is that having applied for grants for myself quite a bit over the years, I haven't recently, but in my career quite often I have, one of the first questions that a foundation usually asks you when you say you want to spend money on journalism is, well, how is this going to become sustainable? And I couldn't tell from the announcement or any of the subsequent publicity that these grants got how that was even possible. In the case of the Los Angeles Times and the Washington Post, they're both businesses that have been losing money and are in trouble, and they have a business model that isn't at the moment working. And it's not clear to me how, when the grant is done, they're going to be in any better position on that long-term challenge than they are now. A third thing that was a question for me was, do the LA Times or the Washington Post have to do anything particularly innovative in order to get this money? I understand it's for news coverage about important issues, and I would certainly agree that immigration and money and politics are vitally important issues, but ordinarily with foundation money, especially from a prestigious foundation like Ford, you kind of have to show that you're doing something that moves the ball down the field, or that represents a departure. And finally, the thing that I thought was strange is even if the grant works in the sense that it produces great journalism and it gets renewed for another year, another 2 years, when it's over, they're still in the same position, which was they can't afford this kind of coverage. And so it just seemed odd to me that Ford Foundation couldn't ask those same kind of questions that anybody looking at this grant would ask.
Jonathan, do you want to address that? You did mention something about digital, that there would be a kind of a digital aspect to this.
Well, the foundation has a balanced portfolio of grants. I mean, just in the last few months, we had an event at the foundation called Change by Design, which was basically around new storytelling techniques that the digital revolution has brought to journalism, new ways of telling stories with data and through multimedia. We had another event called Wired for Change, which again focused on the power of big data to drive different sorts of storytelling and narrative exploration. And then, you know, these grants to more traditional entities like the Los Angeles Times and the Washington Post, I think, demonstrate that there's, in addition to a place for tech and for innovation and for newer voices in the media ecosystem, there is also still a place for organizations that have the commitment and the resources to put in the legwork and to put in the time to report very long lead stories, things that are extremely difficult to develop without that kind of commitment. And I think the future of the media ecosystem is both. We're trying to invest in both aspects of that, to invest in traditional, to invest in emerging models, to invest in things that are just on the horizon. I mean, if you look 10 years ago, right, ProPublica didn't exist, and today ProPublica, which we support, is a really important not-for-profit newsroom that's having impact all over the country. Global Post, which we supported to do a series called The Rainbow Struggle on gay rights worldwide, similarly, it didn't exist, and it kind of arose out of the ashes of some of the destruction that's going on within the news business. So I think that it's natural that that the imperatives of today's marketplace are going to push new kinds of storytelling in these grants, but we haven't explicitly asked for anything. There are no strings attached, and it's up to the newspapers how they intend to cover the beats. The Los Angeles Times beats, by the way, include, in addition to immigration, incarceration and a foreign correspondent in Brazil. So I think there's all kinds of rich content that will come out during the duration of the grant, and you know, we're hopeful that it will also bring renewed focus on just what an important element serious journalism provides in our civic discourse.
Hi, this is Dorian, Jonathan. I was wondering, did you guys has the Ford Foundation in any other instance ever given a grant for the operations of a company that is a for-profit company?
The answer to that is yes. The Internal Revenue Code includes specific examples of funding to for-profits and sets out the rules that apply. So it's anticipated, and we're not the first to do so in this space. The Gates Foundation made a grant to ABC News for coverage of global health issues and also has a partnership with The Guardian, I believe, or had one. The Knight Foundation and its Knight News Challenge is open to for-profit as well as not-for-profit. So there are different philanthropic instruments for that kind of work.
So this is the first one that Ford's ever done like this.
I've only been at Ford, a relatively short time, but I believe that in the journalism space, these two grants are the first two for-profit media.
And Jonathan, you said there was something that said when these grants came out that you would look to kind of other online outlets to do grants to them as well. I know you mentioned ProPublica and some others. So, you know, going forward, let's say there's a lot of people listening to this podcast who are thinking, you know, what would I do, you know, in order to get this kind of grant from Ford? Is there something specific you're looking for from either a traditional or a new media organization to fund? Is there something specific you're looking for?
Well, we're looking to support principal journalistic coverage on complex social issues. Now, that's a pretty broad mandate, but that's the fact. And this initiative, which is managed by my colleague Calvin Sims, you know, has supported all sorts of enterprises. Some are startups, some are traditional, some are purely digital, some are multimedia. As Jay Rosen can tell you better than anybody, this is an unbelievably complex and interconnected media ecosystem, and stories that begin, you know, from a single new voice can wind up all over the web. Things that begin from the LA Times similarly can be syndicated. Everyone is an aggregator these days. And so I think, the answer to the question is that, we look at everything on a case-by-case basis. We don't have unlimited resources. We have a budget that's been fairly consistent in this space. And we try to do some experimental work each year in our grant making, and to balance things that we know are performing really well with some more venture-oriented investments that are keyed towards the future.
Here's what I don't get, Mark, or Jonathan. You said that the LA Times couldn't otherwise afford to do this coverage of, let's say, immigration or incarceration. And let's say it does some excellent work in 2012 and 2013. Maybe it gets renewed in 2014. As things stand now, in 2016, there's still going to be a need to cover immigration. Nothing will have changed, and the LA Times now suddenly will be out of these reporters. What is going to be different when the grant is over that would enable the LA Times to sustain this work? I still don't see it.
It's a fair point. No grant is guaranteed in perpetuity, and we treat these grants the same way we treat any of our grants. We look at them on their merits. We look at them for results. We look at them against our strategy, and you're correct that it may be renewed and it may be renewed again, but it won't necessarily be renewed forever. But again, I think if you just take a snapshot 5 years backwards and 5 years forward, or 10 years backwards and 10 years forward, I think we're looking at a future of hybrid models, and we're trying to reinforce the importance that serious journalism plays in broader public discourse. And in addition, for the pendency of the grants, for the term of the grants, there'll be excellent work that's created. So, you know, we look at both the quality of the work during the grant itself, and then the sense that by making this contribution, the importance will be reinforced and it will help other models develop. But your point is a fair one. This is not something that will necessarily continue forever. That doesn't mean that it isn't worth doing now as a contribution to the evolution of the media ecosystem.
Jonathan, I in preparation for this, just took a look at the Washington Post financials quickly, and if I was reading them correctly, the Washington Post company, not the newspaper division, but the company as a whole, whose major revenue source is the Kaplan Educational Group, was profitable in 2011. Profitable to the tune of almost $300 million. The newspaper division did lose, tens of millions. But I'm wondering, was that at all part of the discussion that, hey, you know, yes, the newspapers aren't self-sustaining. The newspaper isn't self-sustaining, but the company as a whole, does have some profits. Did that kind of consideration ever come up in your discussions?
Well, our focus is on the discourse, not the organizational form. Our focus is on preserving and advancing journalism in the public interest. And today there are all manner of corporate identities for news gathering operations, and we certainly don't want to restrict or make a requirement that a news operation has to be in in some sort of corporate structure or financial distress. You know, our focus is on the fact that in general, over time, there's been a pronounced decline in newsroom personnel, in circulation, in revenues, and consequently, you know, there's less and less reporting on serious social issues, less and less reporting from foreign bureaus. And while there are a lot of innovative new models that have sprung up to respond to that situation, many of which we support, there's also value, we think, in maintaining these centers of excellence around the country. And so, again, our focus here is not really on the organizational form of the newsroom, and we certainly wouldn't want to restrict ourselves only to standalone newsrooms that don't have any other corporate divisions or any other path to long-term success.
Well, thanks a lot. I really appreciate you joining us, Jonathan and Jay as well.
Thank you.
Thanks, Mark, Dorian. Thank you.
Thanks for joining us for another episode of The Media Twits. I'm Mark Glazer, executive editor of PBS Media Shift. I want to thank my co-host, Dorian Benkoil, as well as our guests, Josh Stearns, Jonathan Barzilay, and Jay Rosen. I want to thank PBS and the Knight Foundation for making this podcast possible. Be sure to keep up with all the news, polls, and events at PBS Media Shift at pbs.org/mediashift and our sister site, Idealab, at pbs.org/idealab and our news site, Collaboration Central, at collaborationcentral.org. We'll be off for Thanksgiving next week, but we'll catch you after that. Have a great holiday.